WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Adora Namigadde, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's Friday, so you know what time it is. Time to catch up on what's been happening lately across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap, where we take you behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
Federal agents appear not to have a warrant signed by a judge before going into people's homes.
Trump's Justice Department argues officials, including Mayor Brandon Johnson, are interfering with immigration enforcement.
His threats are real. And I'm going to continue to stand up for working people in this country.
Governor J.B. Pritzker says that in the state of Illinois, they have done nothing but follow the law.
No one who attempts to overthrow a government should serve in government.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker barring employment at the state for January 6 rioters.
To help make sense of the week's news, we were joined by Chicago reporter with Axios, Carrie Shepard, WBEZ city politics reporter, Mariah Wolfel, and to round it out, president of the Better Government Association, David Greising. This week brought new power struggles between the White House and states across the U.S. We began by taking a look at how Illinois has responded to the president's executive orders.
Well, it's clear that the Trump administration is really focusing on Chicago and other sanctuary cities. And this particular lawsuit filed Thursday in federal court accuses those jurisdictions you mentioned of making it more difficult and impeding the federal immigration officers as they seek to carry out their responsibilities, those responsibilities being, from the Trump administration's point of view, the immigration officials who are staging raids with TV personalities like Dr. Phil in tow, getting a lot of good, they hope, TV out of this highly publicized move to track down people whom they think should not be here because they don't have the appropriate papers. And according to the Trump administration, many of them supposedly are criminals that shouldn't be here in the first place.
Mm-hmm. How'd the governor respond to all of this?
Not happy. Governor Pritzker has established himself as kind of a leading voice of criticism of the Trump administration. And on this issue in particular, he has talked about it as being a lawless act, and then kind of hearkened to the President Trump's pardon of January 6th rioters, basically saying this is a president who trying to act above the law and, in fact, is creating lawlessness with some of his acts.
He definitely seems to have a strong stance because I know he said, we look forward to seeing them in court, quote.
Well, right. Well, the legal strategy is where this ultimately is going to play out on a number of different fronts. We've already seen, for example, the Attorney General of the state, Kwame Ruhle, sue to prevent the grant cuts that the Trump administration introduced and then backed off of. And, of course, this action is in the courts thanks to the administration bringing it, but certainly the state of Illinois and other entities in this state likely will respond in kind.
Okay, we're going to see what happens. And Mariah, can you tell us, attorneys are saying that recent immigration arrests may have violated the Constitution. What did your WBEZ colleagues, our colleagues, find out?
Yeah, Adriana Cardona-McGeegod and Alvia Malagon had a great story kind of weaving through a couple of different cases in Lyons and Elgin in the past couple of weeks, where there are questions about what warrants federal enforcement agents were armed with when either going into someone's home, going on their property, or just arresting someone. Anyone in the country is protected by the Fourth Amendment, which protects people against illegal search and seizures. And so the National Immigrant Justice Center is taking the lead on this. They say that they're, you know, digging in. There's one attorney, Mark Fleming, who represents one of the people who was arrested, a father, kind of a family patriarch who owns a business, a food business, who, employs people who are all kind of out of work right now as he's being detained. And so the National Immigrant Justice Center is calling into question whether what types of warrants that ICE is obtaining before seeking arrest. You know, there was another case where they went into a home looking for someone who had a criminal record, but that person was at home and they ended up arresting another person in the home. Unclear what type of warrant they had there. And they also called into question the claim by the Trump administration that the people that they are arresting or going after have criminal records. The Justice Center said about half of the cases they've been able to dig into so far, people have no criminal history.
Wow.
The patriarch who was arrested, he had some municipal traffic, you know, infractions on his record,
really,
but no other criminal record. And so, you know, I think just calling into question, we've asked for those numbers. You know, we've asked Chicago police and the mayor's office for how many of the Chicagoland area detained people have criminal arrest records. And the Chicago police, while they are saying that they trust that the Trump administration and federal enforcement officials are going after who they say they're going after, people with criminal records, they don't have data to back that up because that's not information that they are seeking from the federal government. So that's information that reporters, you know, are being tasked with obtaining on their own from ICE, from, you know, places like the Immigrant Justice Center, who are kind of tracking these things.
Yeah, that's interesting to know that the police don't even have that data from the government themselves.
It's partly possibly because the police and nobody in the state is allowed to participate or support the ICE raids and the other immigration work that the administration is doing. It's unclear whether if they were participating, they would get this kind of information. But surely by completely saying we're going to have nothing to do with this, normal channels of communication are not in effect.
Yeah, well, that's actually an interesting point. The press conference where Police Superintendent Larry Snelling talked about how he doesn't have that data, he also kind of outlined the relationship he does have with ICE and kind of shed light on the information he is getting and said the police, they actually are communicating pretty regularly with ICE ahead of these raids. They know generally what area ICE is targeting. Okay. They don't know specific locations. And this is, you know, what the Superintendent Snelling is saying, and that's, you know, what we take his word for. But, you know, he said that they need to know that information ahead of time so that they can make police deployment staffing decisions based on those things. If there are skirmishes between federal enforcement agents and someone they're trying to arrest, so they might send more officers than usual to that area where they're aware, you know, there might be some tension or raids happening.
Okay, that's helpful to know. And David, this DOJ lawsuit comes on the heels of Mayor Johnson agreeing to testify before Congress about Chicago's sanctuary city status. What are your thoughts on the Justice Department doing this after big city mayors agreed to show up and testify?
Right. Well, Mayor Johnson actually didn't immediately agree to testify. He had the city's chief legal officer take a look at whether he is required to show up and testify. And he now has decided he and the other mayors from Boston and New York, I think, are going to appear. He evidently believes that he's prepared to make the case for Chicago's sanctuary city status and the beneficial effects, as he sees it, of that policy. He also knows that he is walking into the lion's den because the Republican-led committee that is looking into this is absolutely doing the bidding of an administration that believes that sanctuary cities should not exist. This is not a new thing for President Trump. One of the first executive orders he did upon taking office in 2017 was to challenge sanctuary cities per se. So this is a long abiding effort on the part of this particular president and his administration.
Yeah, Chicago and Illinois have been in his crosshairs for a long time, right? And especially Tom Homan, his immigration ICE sort of czar. I wish we had a better name for it than that. and especially for Governor Pritzker, who was, you know, he was quite an advocate and surrogate for Kamala Harris, which is obviously was Trump's opponent. So, you know, this is, and the sanctuary city, I'm not quite sure what Mayor Johnson, I don't know, Mariah, if you have more light to shed on that. I'm not sure what he has to gain by going to testify. testify, quite frankly, to defend a sanctuary city status. This is not something he came up with. This has been around since Harold Washington, so 40 plus years. I don't know, you know, speaking just from the strictly political angle, which might sound cynical. I mean, obviously, this is something he really believes in. I don't think anyone doubts that for a second in his progressive ideals. And he has been very clear. We are a place that will protect immigrants. This is a place where people come to work. They work hard. But I don't know that sitting up there and defending this to a, you know, Republicans who are, they have their, this is not meant to be swayed. That's not what these hearings are about. Mm-hmm. This is not like, this is just kind of grandstanding often, you know, by Congress. So I'm not sure what that helps the mayor in the long run, because I'm not, I don't know that the people who will, if he runs for re-election, will see that and it will change their vote in any which way.
So given those stakes, like, why do you think he changed his mind, Mariah?
Well, I think that he and the city determined that this committee has subpoena power and they weren't going to take it to the that point. I spoke to a senior one of his senior advisors who said, we're not going to blow up the theatrics even more around this. You know, we spoke with the mayors of Denver, Boston, and New York City who, you know, they're all on the same page that, like, they're not going to get to the point where they're being, you know, dragged into Congress and forced to testify, which might even look, you know, more politically bad. You know, he was posed the question at his press conference, you know, if you feel that so strongly about sanctuary cities, by one reporter, if you feel so strongly about sanctuary cities, why not go defend this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was hesitant. He was, he said, like, our attorney's looking this over. And I think at the end of the day, they just decided they weren't going to be subpoenaed, you know, to come in and testify. And to Carrie's point, like, I don't think, like, this is going to be great. You know, like, this, no one who has testified as part of House oversight probes in the past couple of years, including presidents of universities and anti-Semitism probes, have really ended up, you know, looking great after these testimonies.
People are blow off subpoenas all the time to these hearings. Jim Jordan, you know, I mean, and then, like, they're on to this, you know, this panel's on to the next issue, right? And defend it to whom? He's defending it to members of Congress that don't live here. Mm-hmm. They're not from here. You know, I mean, this is a local ordinance. This is something that we follow here. I don't know that him going there to defend, he's already defended it to the people who live here, who vote here, who pay taxes.
But I would say that he will have Democrats on the committee who will be asking friendly questions and will give him an opportunity to make the case for sanctuary cities. There is a case to be made, whether you agree with it or not, for sanctuary cities. And to do so, even if he does end up going toe-to-toe with Republicans who may or may not be really seeking the truth. They were just, you know, making political points. Maybe he thinks he's up to it. You know, he's pretty quick on his feet in these areas, especially where his heart rests. And clearly, as you pointed out, Carrie, this is an area where his heart does rest.
Yeah, it does. I don't think there's any question that he believes firmly in sanctuary cities. I don't think so at all. I don't know what he really has to gain politically from it, but, you know.
Well, do you think he might be having second thoughts about testifying after yesterday's lawsuit?
You know, I think that remains to be seen, the most cliche answer, but truly, I don't think as of now, nothing has changed. You know, they are still planning to go. You know, they may change their prep given the lawsuit in some way, but, you know, it was filed, you know, 48 hours ago, 24 hours ago. So I think that we'll see. But right now it's March 5th.
So the deadline for federal workers to accept the government's buyout was supposed to expire yesterday, but a federal judge delayed that until at least Monday. David, this is impacting workers all over the country, including right here in Chicago, where more than 100 employees of the Environmental Protection Agency received a job warning via email. Can you fill us in on what's going on?
Well, It is part of this national picture, as you pointed out, that the work of that office will basically, unless something changes between now and then, will grind to a halt. This is not an isolated incident. It raises bigger questions about the functioning of government, but clearly the EPA, like the Education Department and other large parts of the government that are under fire from this administration, and that outside influence of the DOGE, the Elon Musk-led Department of Government Efficiency, that we're going to see this play out. And as with sanctuary cities, we now have kind of a battleground over this issue. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting choice, frankly, in the from the administration's perspective, because this particular office is very involved in protecting the Great Lakes, our drinking water, mm-hmm. one of the world's largest supplies of fresh water, something that people, going back to Mayor Emanuel and others, have talked about as being one of the greatest resources mm-hmm. that we in the city, not to mention in the region, have. And so to be saying, what's the point of having this office is really raising a fundamental question.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, I talked to Nicole Cantello. She's the head of the EPA local union here. And so there's a few things, like David notes, that are really at play. This also raises major labor issues because the federal government is the largest employer in the Chicago region, you know, something like close to 50,000 people. And they all have contracts with their separate unions. And so if you you know, Trump is threatening their collective bargaining agreements if he says, you know, buy out this. And their union leaders are like, wait, hold on. You can't do that. But the other thing she said is, you know, when this was earlier when, you know, Trump had said all federal workers have to come back to the office. And she said that, you know, their contracts have stipulations for telework, which would be sort of in office half the week and then also remote. And then, you know, some people have it grandfathered in that they work remotely. But she said, so that's just one part. We're also worried, as David notes, of the environmental impact and sort of the threats to the work we do. That is central. And if we have even fewer people in our office, how do we accomplish that work? Mm-hmm. So it's twofold. You know, it's like people like can sort of sneer and say like, oh, you have to go to the office. Big deal. Well, there's many layers to that as well. But it's not just that. It's that they're feeling threatened on several levels.
Okay. And turning to fallout from one of Donald Trump's executive orders, an Illinois mother filed a lawsuit having to do with gender-affirming care for her child. What are the details of that?
Yeah, this was, I think this was filed in Maryland. And this was a mother whose child was getting care at UI Health. And I think the day before the surgery, the surgeon canceled the surgery. Mm. This is something that, again, is causing a lot of confusion. I called Lurie Children's Hospital, you know, when this first came down that, you know, President Trump said that he was stopping gender affirming care. Lurie has really been at the forefront of this. They've had a program for a long time. And they said they're still reviewing the executive order to understand what they can do. But it is hearkening a lot back, if we remember, of the dismantling of Roe, right? Mm-hmm. Of you have these healthcare providers and clinics saying, I don't know what I'm allowed to do. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm like, if I'm going to lose my job, if I'm more importantly, lose my license. But you know, you have these patients who are in the middle of treatment. So like just stopping isn't an option. The other issue the mother raises is obviously the severe mental health impact that this could have on her child if her child is not able to have this surgery. I think that it's important too when we, you know, Trump lays out these executive orders about transgender care, gender affirming care, transgenders, is to understand that the professionals, the American Medical Association, the Pediatric Association, this is all care that they support. These are all professional organizations of doctors, medical professionals, they support this. So, you know, we need to push back a little and make sure also that we're presenting the facts. Like, you know, I heard a clip of him not too long ago. This is a separate issue of like DEI is illegal. Well, DEI is not illegal, just to be clear, you know, so like that's another thing. And, you know, we don't have to get into the conspiracy theories of the gender affirming care of things that have been thrown around. But it's important to understand also that like, you know, puberty blockers, they're temporary, you know, and there's a Harvard study, something like 0.1 or something percent of young people received these. So we have to like, you know, it's like the ban yesterday. Trump issued this ban on transgender athletes. I saw the New York Times number. There are 500,000 NCAA athletes, okay, college athletes. There are 10 transgender athletes.
So, Carrie, you mentioned the Roe decision, the Dobbs decision took out Roe v. Wade, the federal right to abortion. And in the concurrence on that opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas sort of signaled that this might lay the groundwork for going after gender-affirming issues, going after gay marriage, et cetera, et cetera. And it was always thought that that would happen kind of through the judicial process.
Right.
Challenges at courts that would make their way up to the Supreme Court take years to adjudicate. What's happening here is this administration has basically decided, well, this is the way it needs to be, and this is the way it's going to be, and these are going to become facts on the ground that now, if you want to go to court, you've got to overturn us.
Right.
And they're creating all kinds of disruption and change immediately. We're just not used to seeing government kind of change course, reverse itself so quickly. And that's one of the things that's highly unusual right now.
Yeah. And the question becomes, too, I talked to a legal expert last week about this, is like it comes back to the states. You know, Attorney General Kwame Raoul has said, we will continue to defend, you know, this is in our state will continue several states, but it's already been overturned in many states across the country. But in Illinois, we will continue to offer gender affirming care. So it's unclear why UI Health, I didn't report this story, so I didn't, you know, I haven't called them. I don't know why they made this decision. It's unclear. But other organizations have said, we'll continue to provide the care that Illinois says we can provide.
Okay. Thank you, Carrie, for explaining that. So Mariah, can you tell us about Governor Pritzker? He says he's banning pardoned January 6th rioters from any state jobs. Mayor Johnson was asked whether he might follow suit for city jobs. What did the mayor say?
The mayor declined to, you know, say anything on it, really. He did praise that action. He said it's the right action to do, but didn't go so far as to say the city will mirror that, and said, you know, he was kind of talking out both sides of his mouth because he said it's a good idea, but then said he hasn't made a decision on what the city will do, and then also said, you know, at the same time, we have to have a high standard. You know, Mayor Johnson has come under fire for not working aggressively to root out Chicago police officers, for example, with extremist ties from the department. His office declined to take a recommendation from the Office of Inspector General to create a task force on this issue. And so that's kind of a tangent, but this isn't a new issue for Mayor Brandon Johnson or a new type of like controversy. I think, you know, what his team has told me is that they're trying to weigh, you know, the legal implications of barring certain people from city employment with certain criminal backgrounds. And I think they have concerns about how that, you know, policy precedent could be utilized in the future to ban people from jobs whose political views don't align, you know, and that's kind of an extreme example. Maybe it seems extreme to some people, but that's something that they're weighing, you know, whether you agree with that or not. And so then at the same time, a group of city council members, four council members, led by a veteran, Alderman Gilbert Villegas, introduced a resolution that would bar January 6th, people who participated in January 6th from employment. The way that Pritzker did it at the state level is by, you know, basically directing the agency charged with hiring to consider, you know, acts, arrests related to January 6th as, you know, behavior that violates the state's personnel code. I don't know the exact adjectives, but it would, you know, violate the state's personnel code. So that resolution kind of mirrors that language.
Okay.
And we'll see where it goes in city council.
We'll see. You'll update us next week. David, Governor Pritzker seems to have become a leader in the Democratic resistance to Trump. Is that true?
I think it's true. I mean, you kind of see him everywhere, the Sunday morning shows, frequently on CNN, et cetera, talking about this. I think that Governor Pritzker, first of all, I think some of these positions he's taking very much come from really grounded beliefs that he personally holds. But he's also seeing what's happening, I think, in terms of this is a struggle between federal power and states' rights. And as the governor of one of the larger states, as somebody who has a national profile already and really wants to build his national profile and perhaps establish himself as a viable candidate for the presidency next time around, it's in his personal and political self-interest to do this, especially since he believes what he's saying, not just taking political positions.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I think there's a really valid question for people here who have elected him governor of Illinois is the state better off because he is taking these positions and carving out this role? One might argue if he strongly believes what he is saying, he has a moral obligation to speak out. But there's a more pragmatic consideration, which is, is this going to make Illinois even more of a target than it already is? Are we going to, is the state going to suffer consequences from a president who has shown a willingness to withdraw federal funding for major programs, for infrastructure projects, et cetera, et cetera? And so that's something that the governor and his staff will have to be wrestling with as events unfold going into the future.
Okay. And David, let's discuss another executive order, this time coming from the Department of Transportation, which could jeopardize Illinois road and infrastructure projects. What are the details on that?
I'm sorry, I'm missing on that one.
Oh, it's okay. I'm gonna throw you a bone here. So the Department of Transportation. It's okay. You've been answering a lot.
Our three brains will piece it together.
Yeah, you know what? I haven't contributed any info yet, really. Oh, so yeah. this is my chance to shine. Okay.
We're back at you. You do this one.
The Department of Transportation says funding should, quote, give preference to communities with marriage and birth rates
yes.
higher than the national average. What are your takes?
Well, it's troubling. That's from the new transportation secretary who has been, and he's Sean Duffy. Duffy. I'm getting the gift
yes,
from Dave.
You got a thumbs up.
My buddy Dave.
Yay, producers.
Yay. So let's just be clear. This is not, he's been very open about this in the past. He's very strong in his beliefs about, talks pro-family. He and his wife have 9 children. And great, live your life. But he's all about kind of what J.D. Vance, Vice President Vance, is about, is that, you know, we're building the family unit. That's what's most important. We need to give preference to people, you know, heteronormative marriages that then also have children, and that's the nuclear family unit, and that's what we, you know, subscribe to. I'm not sure, and it's like, as David was talking about Pritzker, as a Trump attacking Illinois with various programs, it's just like such a strange legal gray area of like how you can actually do that.
To redlining also is a question I have.
Well, yeah. Our transportation system already does, right? I mean, we have been waiting and waiting with bated breath to get this extension of the red line for decades at this point. And we finally feel mm-hmm. like former President Biden, you know, he's like, yes, former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, they pushed this across the line. This was CTA president, his swan song, you know, as he departed the agency. He's like, look, I made this happen. And immediately it was like those dreams were almost burst, because it was like, is President Trump's administration going to strip this funding from us? We have mm-hmm. been waiting for this. And when you say redlining, the point being that, you know, the red line literally cuts off at 95th Street.
Yeah.
Chicago goes on for a long time past that. Mm-hmm. So you're cutting a huge swath of the city off, the majority African-American part of the city off from actual public transportation in the city. So, yes, it probably would in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. I feel like there's so many themes emerging here. One, like every question you ask is like another executive order. And like the answer is kind of like, what are the legal implications here? How do you actually implement this? You know, in terms of, you know, cutting off funding for certain cities or certain communities, we have to remember that the Trump administration did try to do that in their first term to Chicago, to sanctuary cities, and try to, you know, stop the federal funding flowing to sanctuary cities. And they lost that fight in court. Chicago, you know, sued over that and was able to maintain its, you know, federal funding. And so I think, like, with these executive orders coming out, everyone, and I feel like, you know, Democratic leaders do know this too, that it's like important to take a beat and to question what these are prefaced on or premised on and go from there.
It's not surprising if the red line does become a target, though, because literally just on his way out of the White House, President Biden locked in this federal commitment.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so this does seem to be setting the table for the president to withdraw what is now, as it stands, a binding commitment to provide, I think, more than $1 billion in support for this project. And so it would be a big win for Trump if he can figure out a way to undo that. So that might be what's going on in this incident that I had missed in the flood of news this week. I apologize.
Hey, it's okay. I'm going to ask you something about the Trump administration overall that I think you're going to know. Okay.
Okay.
The Trump administration really seems to be testing the limits of federal powers. So where's Illinois in this struggle compared to other states?
Illinois is becoming a big battleground, probably more than any other state that comes to mind, just because of the multitude of issues that have already come up and that we've been talking about. And what's underlying part of this is new theories of presidential power, something called the unitary executive theory, which gives the president virtually unchallenged power to make decisions about the operations of the federal government. A couple of members of the Supreme Court have expressed support for this theory, and President Trump clearly is testing that. One of the theories here is that he's inviting things like the challenges to his actions, in part to have a chance at winning and establishing really a new theory of federal government in which the states really have very little power vis-a-vis the federal government's authority, and especially the president's authority. This is partly president versus Congress, with the closing, for example, of the USAID, the foreign support agency, which is a creation of Congress and funded by Congress. The president shutting that down is a test of presidential power. And perhaps one of the reasons that Governor Pritzker is standing up as he is, and the Attorney General Kwame Ruhl joined the lawsuit challenging the cutoff of federal grant funding, is because they're fighting back saying, hey, we represent states and we're going to stand up. And at the end of the day, the court is going to have to decide. And it's going to be very interesting because this existing Supreme Court, like I said, already has a couple of announced supporters of the unitary executive theory, but there have been others on the court, even some of the conservative members, who have been more deferential to the powers of Congress. So when these do ultimately make their way to the Supreme Court, it'll be a little bit of a toss-up. You'll have to pay close attention, obviously, to argument before the court, and then we won't, of course, know until the decisions come in.
The political strategy, too, of going after Illinois is, let's remember, we are a blue state, but we're a blue state for sort of a quarter top of our state. So most of the state is actually red. The reason we often go blue is because Cook County is so large, and that's what predominantly votes blue. Even the collar counties, they have sort of swapped back and forth over the past few elections. So, you know, I think there's probably somebody wise in Trump's orbit who's saying, look, there's plenty of sympathetic people in the state of Illinois, sympathetic with our policies and ideologies that we can, you know, that we are speaking to. So it is as opposed to sort of a full blue state that they're like, well, we're not going to waste our time with Vermont. You know, I don't know, you know, like we, whatever. And also we're a powerful state. We're actually, there's a lot of money in our state, you know, right? So that's one of the reasons. I just wanted to say real quick too, I just have this, like with all of this, I've been thinking so much, like David's talking about governing and Mariah's talking about like sort of this governing by executive order. I have this image, I don't know if you guys remember this, of President Trump during his first term, and he was sort of in a showdown in the Oval Office with then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and then Senator Schumer. And, you know, Pelosi is, you know, she doesn't mince words, and she's like, look, and it was on the, you know, the cusp of one of our many government shutdowns that was about to happen. And she's like, look, this is not how we govern. This is not how we legislate, by ultimatum, by threats. We have to negotiate. That's what we do. I'm not saying that Congress is infallible. Many of them are not. But like the point was that like we don't do this top down thing. You've got to work together. That's what the legislative branch is for. That's what we elected them to do. And she's just like, and it really like stuck with me of like, yeah, this is a new style of governance. This is how I guess the democracy works now, this sort of executive order that then creates confusion.
Or how you peel away at the democracy.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
Yeah, thank you for that summary. Let's talk about the teachers' contract. The Chicago Teachers Union rejected a mediator's recommendations for a new contract. David, what are teachers objecting to?
Well, it's odd because the finding of this fact finder's report was that the school district has enough money to pay the teachers the 5% pay raise that they are seeking. But apparently that's not good enough for Stacey Davis Gates, the president of the CTU. She noted that the fact finder recommendations addressed only two of the 15 issues that the union raised in its 86-page brief. And therefore, I guess the whole thing is illegitimate. It seems odd. Talk about looking a gift horse in the mouth. This has strengthened, the finding of the fact finder has strengthened the union's hand in these negotiations. It also has cleared one of the hurdles that are required before the union can call a strike. But it's evident that Stacey Davis Gates, who knows she has the backing of City Hall in whatever she does, given that Mayor Brandon Johnson used to work for the union, is flexing her muscles and clearly, it seems like, wanting to go out and strike.
Yeah, I think she's keeping her options open. You know, like you said, is one of the hurdles that you have to go through in order to authorize a strike, and it's kind of become that, legal step to doing so. And so now when either one of the sides rejects the findings of the fact finder report, they have a 30-day cooling off period before they can strike. And so it's just kind of a necessary step if you get to the point where you do want to authorize a strike. But she did say that, you know, she doesn't see that being necessary. And so it is, you know, interesting. And she also characterized this as the most favorable report, fact finder report, that they've gotten in 15 years, and was almost surprised at how favorable it was for the union. The fact finder agreed with the union's demands, you know, for instance, to bring in more librarians across in schools, but I guess didn't opine about or didn't agree with them on things like prep time, which is a huge sticking point in their contract negotiations, how much time teachers are paid to prep before school. And so that's a big one that they're still working through. A lot of, I think, the sticking points have been non-economic sticking points, like instruction, like prep time. And so I don't think a strike is out of the question. I think, you know, this checks a box for them on that road. And, we'll just have to see.
Okay, so, David, what's next? Back to the bargaining table?
Well, back to the bargaining table, but it does seem to be the point at which the good faith bargaining is not really happening anymore. It does seem to be, it have reached a point where it's the two sides kind of digging in and getting ready for a strike. And I think It just looks likely at this point. And this certainly would strengthen union leadership's hand in being able to say, listen, an independent fact finder has said the school district has the money, so that it strengthens the resolve of members to stay on a picket, if there is a strike, to stay on a picket line longer and hold out for what they think they are due. And as Mariah points out, it's only partly about the economics, and they're looking for a real sea change in staffing and resources in a school system where many schools have very few students, and the idea of putting librarians and social workers and other supports in some of these schools with, you know, less than 100 students is quite questionable.
Yeah, and I think, like, it would just be remarkable to see a teacher strike under Mayor Brandon Johnson, as you pointed out, who comes from the CTU. Like, I don't think that we would have expected such acrimony between CPS and the CTU under Johnson, who controls the school board, which, you know, in theory controls CPS's CEO, but all this is, you know, a wrench has been thrown in all of that because of the acrimony that has grown between CPS CEO Pedro Martinez and the union. You know, the board voted to fire Martinez, but he's able to stay on under his contract for another 6 months to see, which they didn't want. You know, they wanted him out so they could negotiate the contract that they want. And so it's just going to be really interesting to see how it plays out in the next couple of months.
This week, an alder was actually ejected. Mariah, what happened?
Our arts and culture reporter was covering this hearing, and I said, man, you really hit the City Hall bingo card with covering this hearing. There was drama and aldermen ejected, fights about free
committee
speech. But it was a hearing on a controversial, installation at the Cultural Center in Chicago that criticizes Israel and America's role in funding Israel's war in Gaza. And, there are aldermen who want that exhibition taken down. And so it was a hearing on that kind of unraveled between Alderman Bill Conway, who I believe signed on to a letter asking for the, piece to be taken down, and, you know, progressive firebrand, as he's often called, Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez, who said he didn't see anything controversial about this art, that art is supposed to be provocative. And, you know, at one point, you know, they're yelling at each other. Conway brings up this former incident where Byron Sigcho Lopez was at a protest where a veteran burned an American flag in protesting Israel. And it blows up, and Byron Sigcho Lopez screams white supremacist as he ends his comment. And it appears that that's being directed at Conway. That's how any reasonable person would have read that. And Alderman Exposito, who's one of the council's most conservative aldermen, and told me that he believes calling someone a white supremacist is the same as using the N-word. So that kind of gives you an idea of his politics. It's not the right committee to use that phrase by Sigcho Lopez. He kind of kicks him out right away and says, get out of here. You can't use that language. Unclear to me if aldermen can kick each other out of a meeting. But Byron Sigcho Lopez left voluntarily, and then Sposato recessed the meeting. Sigcho Lopez apologized to Conway. Conway says, you know, it's fine. He apologized. He said it wasn't directed at me, but in general, towards the council and this body for, you know, undergoing this hearing in the first place about, you know, provocative art that's criticizing the country's, you know, policies, and that he didn't want to escalate it further. So that's kind of the lowdown. You know, we didn't really do a lot of digging into this because it was just kind of a tiff that happens, that, you know, things are really heated right now. They're always heated when talking about the war, and they're always heated when, you know, there's this increasing divide between progressives and more moderates and conservatives on the council. And so it's kind of a symptom of all of that.
Okay.
Wow. That's a lot, summary. Mariah.
That's a good summary.
Who needs fiction or, you know, reality TV when you can get the real stuff with our local government?
The owner of the Chicago Bears has died at 102 years old. David, can you tell us about Virginia McCaskey and her legacy?
Well, her legacy and her history is, in essence, the history of the National Football League and the Chicago Bears. I think she was 3 years old. The NFL was formed 3 years before she was born. And she was in her 60s when they won the Super Bowl, which shows how far back she
goes. Long-suffering. Okay.
So she was the daughter of George Halas. Her brother died, and as a result, she became chair of the Bears, the majority shareholder and really controlling party. And even though she didn't dabble in day-to-day affairs, she definitely had influence on the team. George McCaskey, who's been running the team lately, memorably said that Virginia McCaskey was pissed off about how poorly the Bears were playing under Mark Trestman right after Trestman was fired. She was revered throughout the league. Mm-hmm. She was a woman of deep faith. She had a bumper sticker on her car that said, say the rosary or something to that effect. she lived notably in a very modest Desplaines home with 11 children. And she, after learning a very difficult personal lesson, she became very close to Brian Piccolo, who died of leukemia. Mm. She swore kind of never to become very close with another player again. The only one she really got close with over the years was Walter Payton. Mm. She developed a very close relationship and deep respect for Walter Payton and considered him the best player in the history of the franchise. Mm. More recent players who were interviewed after she died talked about how they just thought it was just incredible just to meet and be in her presence, because for them, she was a part of NFL history and certainly this franchise's history.
You know, fun fact, my brother lives in Philadelphia, and he actually texted me about her death because he said she's the number one funder of the church that he goes to. So now they're all wondering, what's going to happen or how are they going to honor her? Carrie, she had some pretty traditional, some might say old school views of her role in the Bears organization. Can you shed some light on that?
Well, I think as David mentioned, I think she was a little more involved than people thought, right, in kind of the day-to-day. And I think that this is sort of a criticism of the Bears that everybody thinks they maybe need to update the franchise a little bit and sort of think they need to, you know, this is one of the oldest teams and, you know, they haven't been doing great. That's a really nice way to say it. So they need a real revamp. But, you know, she was like, I mean, you know, one of the very few women that was like heading up a team and, you know, deeply cared about it, obviously. And like her brother died. She's lost a couple of her sons, I believe, have died. So I don't know where it goes, where the Bears go after Virginia now. Do you know, David?
Well, the family has said that the family has the ability to retain control of the team. There will be considerable financial pressure because there's been a move by private equity firms into professional sports, and the value of teams has gone up so much. But
and the Bears are still considered valuable. I mean, they're an iconic team.
Considered to be worth about $6 billion, some people think. One interesting thing about...
Everyone, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we have John back on the phone. Yes. Remember how... The call dropped, so...
I thought you were going to say there's a verdict, but no. Let's hear from John.
Well, John's going to tell us. So, John, you work for the Chicago Sun-Times. You're a federal court reporter. Can you tell us how things are at the Dirksen Federal Courthouse?
Sure. We suddenly have a little bit of drama here. No verdict.
Okay. Oh, okay.
We did finally... We got a rather substantive note from the jury just a little bit ago that they just dealt with in court. It's kind of in the weeds on the instructions. It was just a good sign. The jurors are paying attention to all the words, all the instructions. I don't think that the answer that they got back was necessarily great for Michael Madigan. We'll have to see. His defense attorneys were protesting. But the bottom line is they asked about language in the instructions referring to bona fide salaries and wages and whether or not those can be considered things of value under these specific laws where Madigan is charged. And basically what they're going to be told is that if they're obtained by means of bribery, then the answer to that is yes. So we try and like glean a little insight into where they are with this. This question applies to counts that appear in almost all of the five schemes in which he is charged. Using things like email to promote unlawful activity, but there's also wire fraud charges that they were asking about. And those appear in the scheme dealing with a state board seat for Danny Solis and also a parking lot in Chinatown. So it gives us a little bit more insight into where they are.
Okay, John, thanks for that explanation. And really quickly, I've got like 30 seconds. Do you think we could get a verdict today?
I think we could. They've been going for a long time, but I don't know. Maybe this has been something that they're hung up on, and now that they have the answer from the judge, maybe it helps them reach an answer rather quickly. By the way, just real quick, an extra piece of drama. It was not Judge Blakey on the bench today. He is unavoidably absent, so the emergency judge, Judge Chang, he handled this on the bench today.
Interesting. Okay, John, thank you so much for that quick update, and we're so happy that we did get you in, like, right before the end of the bell, so thank you.
Sorry about all the trouble. You bet.
I would add juries famously try to reach verdicts before the weekend. So
it is Friday. Just trying to get to that weekend.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia. Every Friday, we bring you the roundup of the biggest headlines of the week. To stay informed and never miss an episode, subscribe wherever you listen, or you can find us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Adora Namigadde, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Take care, and thanks for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.